what your country can do for you.
You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
Shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Government is not the solution to our problem.
Do not have sexual relations with that woman.
Constitute an axis of evil.
You still want to see us fall backwards.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's all things political for this Monday, the 20th of August. And our guest this hour is David Zwerdlich. He's a contributing editor for The Root, which is a daily online magazine that provides commentary on the news from a variety of black perspectives. We have a lot to talk about, centering mostly on the presidential campaign. We'll talk about Vice President Biden's controversial comments about chains. We will talk about taxes and whether or not it makes a difference to anybody if tax forms are released. I was interested in that montage that we're running now before this show. There's not a liberal America and a conservative America. There's a United States of America. I think we'll talk a little bit about that. The president, our guest, says has received a lot of disrespect. We will talk about that. We will look at these incredible comments from Missouri Republican Senate candidate Todd Akin talking about rape. And I want to talk about the number of commercials that are already on television. You can't turn on the TV without, if you're watching 2 minutes, you got at least a minute and a half of commercials. Are we all going to tune out as a result of this? So we're going to talk about a number of issues with David, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always go to our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, David. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. Before we talk about Vice President Biden and listen to those comments, you talk about in one of your columns the amount of disrespect that the president has received over the years. Can you talk more about that? Do you think that he's receiving a lot of disrespect now?
I do, and I think it's gone on throughout his presidency, and it went on in both the 08 and the 2012 campaigns. Here's what I'm saying about disrespect. Look, clearly we have a country that's pretty closely divided, liberal, conservative, or Republican, Democrat, however you want to characterize it. So it's not that it's disrespectful to disagree with him or even vehemently disagree with him or vote against him. In fact, remember, even though Obama won pretty handily in 2008, there were 49 million people who voted for McCain. So clearly, it's not disrespectful just to say, hey, this is not my guy. I don't like what he's doing. Where the disrespect comes in, Kathleen, is when people without any sort of real basis, without any evidence, without any justification, tag him as a socialist or a Marxist. When people say, in my view anyway, that he's in over his head, or he, you know, Romney likes to say he, quote unquote, doesn't understand how the economy works. You know, that's a very different kind of critique than simply saying, hey, I don't like his policies. Hey, he could have done a better job. Hey, I didn't want him in there to begin with. So that, and that's what I'm referring to by disrespect. He's still the president of the United States.
Harsher than other presidents have received harsher disrespect?
Well, I know that one common retort to everything I just said is that, well, when President Bush, George W. Bush, was the president, there was a lot of that same kind of hyperbole directed at him from the left. And I do think that's true, and I don't think that was excusable either. I think that there were some things that conservatives will defend Bush on where I personally think he doesn't deserve to be defended on, let's say the invasion of Iraq. I mean, no matter where you started, in my view, that has clearly come to be the consensus of Americans that that was a mistake. But there are other times where people did, on the left, did criticize Bush, and it was over the top. It doesn't speak well of either side, in my view, to make a critique that's not based on what someone actually does. When people talked about Bush, and certainly now when people talk about Obama, there's a lot of criticism that has to do with, well, this is what we think they think. How about just criticizing our presidents, our members of Congress, et cetera, on what they actually do, what they vote on, what they say, not what we secretly think their agenda is. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm coming from.
Let's talk about taxes for a moment. Sure. You wrote a piece recently saying in a move that's sure to leave political pros scratching their heads, Mitt Romney put the subject of his own as yet undisclosed tax returns back into the spotlight. He thinks the public and the media's fascination is small-minded, saying every year I paid at least 13%, which is going to raise a lot of eyebrows because 13% seems extremely low compared to what other Americans pay. Is this something that we really don't care about, David, or is this an important issue and he simply is going to have to release these?
Well, that's the real question, isn't it, Kathleen? I, as a writer, don't care that much about it for the reason that I'm not expecting, if he ever does release his returns, to find something in there that I didn't really already know. I suppose there could be a surprise, but really, in the end, we know Romney is an extraordinarily wealthy businessman. We know that a lot of his money comes from investments, and so he's paying a capital gains rate on a lot of his wealth as opposed to an income tax rate, so it's going to be lower. And with someone with that kind of wealth can get the best accountants that money can buy to reduce their tax burden, and I think it's fair to say any of us would do that if we had that similar amount of wealth. So I don't see a big surprise coming. My concern with Romney, and I think this is a concern, I saw a poll where it said 68% of people think he should release the tax returns. I think what's problematic for Romney, Kathleen, is that when he says, I won't release them, given that other presidential candidates have released them, he's sort of saying, these rules don't apply to me, and I don't really care what the American people think. And that is the bigger problem than what's actually in the returns. I had written that piece last week. You know, there's been so much news about Joe Biden and now about Congressman Aiken and Medicare and Paul Ryan that this got a little bit buried. But last Thursday, Romney sort of brought up the subject of his own tax returns again. I'm not sure why that was the part about, you know, I'm not sure what his consultants were thinking. But in any case, I analogized it to Obama and the American flag pin back in 2008. You know, your listeners will probably remember there was that couple of week period in 2008 where folks were taking notice and say, hey, Obama's starting to really get some momentum in this campaign. Why doesn't he wear an American flag pin?
I remember.
And that's one of those things where, let's face it, right? It didn't actually change Obama to put the flag pin on. He wears it all the time now. It didn't change his positions. I don't think it's changed the way a lot of voters felt about him. But by putting that pin on, in my view, Obama was essentially saying, hey, if this is what American people want from their prospective president, I'll put the flag pin on. And that's where I think the issue comes down with Romney and the tax returns.
Mm-hmm.
You're Romney, you're saying, hey, I want to be your president. People want to see my tax returns. Here's the returns. Maybe not 10 years, maybe not 12 years, but hey, how about 4 years, 6 years of your returns, just so people feel like this guy is trying to reach out to people as opposed to hide something, you know?
Let's talk about Paul Ryan for a moment. The New York Times had a really interesting front page story yesterday about this on-again, off-again, five-year courtship between Romney and Ryan to get the conservative base and to get agreement on whether or not they shared the same viewpoint on fiscal issues, et cetera. What are the overtones, the political overtones of this choice? What do you think about this choice? And do you see the two of them at odds on some issues, or are they fundamentally in agreement and make a strong team?
Well, I think it's a strong choice. And, I've been somewhat familiar with Ryan. I'm getting more familiar with Ryan. I know your listeners in Wisconsin are familiar with Congressman Ryan. I think it was a very strong choice. After a week or so of the coverage and how much energy the Romney campaign has sort of generated off of the choice of Congressman Ryan as his running mate, it's hard to imagine who else he would have picked. I mean, it's hard to imagine the energy of the last week in politics coming from Governor Tim Pawlenty or coming from Senator Rob Portman, the other guys who were really in the running. So now it seems almost like, you know, a no-brainer, but it wasn't a no-brainer 2 weeks ago. And I think what they figured out was that they couldn't play it totally safe with a Rob Portman type pick, and they couldn't go for the complete Hail Mary like a Sarah Palin pick. They had to find someone in between those, and I think Ryan was that. On the one hand, he's a very young guy with some controversial views. On the other hand, he's a young, energetic, a good-looking guy with a good-looking family, and he's very charismatic out on the trail. Even for folks who disagree with him on the issues, I think people in their heart of hearts would say he comes across as a charismatic guy. So I think it was a strong pick for Romney. Yeah.
And what is this thing about good-looking family? The president's family has been described as a good-looking family as well. Ryan's family, a good-looking family. Does that make a difference to us?
Well, Kathleen, I didn't mean to go for the cliche, but they are a good-looking family. The Ryans are a good-looking family. The Romneys are a good-looking family.
Right.
The Obamas are, and the Bidens are.
Right.
I think as a practical matter, if you're a political consultant, here's your calculation. People are going to be looking at these people on TV all day, every day, potentially for 4 or 8 years. Let's have them be kind of good-looking, right? I mean, whether that's right or wrong, I think that's a calculation. For the voter, though, I do think people, whether it's right or wrong, and whether this says something good or bad about our society, people do want to feel good about who we choose as our representatives, and certainly as our president and vice president, and it kind of helps that if you have people who cut this picturesque image, whether you have a Norman Rockwell image in your mind or something else, they really do fit that. And all four of these families, Bidens, Obamas, Ryans, and Romneys, fit that sort of Norman Rockwell-esque portrait when you look at them. So I just think that's the reality of our politics right now.
Well, we're speaking of television, and before we talk about Vice President Biden's comments last week, let's look at the ads. The effect of Citizens United is going to be extraordinary, I think. I watch some news on television, and I got to tell you, David, I saw 2 minutes of presidential commercials in a 2.5-minute period of time, and then the next commercial break. It is extraordinary.
Yeah, no, it is, and I'm not sure what kind of, you just described, right, the kind of ads you're seeing in Wisconsin. I'm actually, even though I work out of an office in D.C., I'm based in North Carolina, and we're sort of considered a swing state. You know, ironically, I would say Wisconsin is one of those Democratic-leaning states that might go for Ryan and Romney, and North Carolina is the opposite, right? We're one of those Republican-leaning states that just this one time, last time, went for Obama and Biden. But in both states, because they're quote-unquote swing states, we do see a lot of ads. I do think that it goes both ways, right? The way you described it, it sounded like, you know, you're getting a little turned off by the thought of, hey, I'm going to be hearing this for the next 78 days nonstop.
Right.
On the other hand, though, these consultants and political pros, they really do focus group these things. They really do research. And I don't think they would run them if they didn't think they were effective for them. You know, it's a business. Politics in that sense is a business. So, you know, some ads are more effective than others, but I will say this. I do think there's a slot in there for one of these campaigns to grab the high ground. I mean, both campaigns are running fairly negative ads. There's a window there where either Obama or Romney could grab the high ground if they wanted. But the question is, do they think that's going to be effective for them?
So you're looking for kind of a Norman Rockwell moment.
Yeah, I guess exactly. I mean, not just the imagery, that too, of course, but also, both campaigns, I think, are running on the idea that there's something wrong with the other guy. Romney is saying Obama hasn't gotten the job done. He's saying it a little more strenuously than that. And Obama is saying you can't take a chance on Romney. That's not the same as saying, hey, this is what I've done for you, and I'm going to do this in the future. Neither of them.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay.
Still there.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Let's take one phone call, and then we'll move into the comments, controversial comments from Vice President Joe Biden. Nathan in Baraboo, hi.
Hi. Our guest here has said that the president has received a lot of criticism. Well, perhaps he deserves it. You know, our president has spent more than all the presidents combined up to this point. Our president has said that he supports gay marriage, when we know that in the vast, vast majority of states where that has been on a ballot, the American people don't. You know, he doesn't think as the American people think. You know, our president won't even say the Pledge of Allegiance. He refuses to put his hand on his heart for the pledge. These are facts.
Nathan, what are you talking about? He spent more money than any other all the other presidents combined. What are you talking about?
Under our current presidential administration, our president has put our country into more debt, more deficit spending than any than all of the other presidents up until this point combined.
David, your thoughts on all those comments. Yes, please.
Can I jump in there, Kathleen?
Yeah. Sure.
So, so Nathan, I think you raise a valid point, right? Presidents are elected, and we hire them and fire them based on the vote every 4 years. And I don't want you or any of Kathleen's other listeners to say that I'm in any way suggesting that Obama or Bush or whoever's the next president shouldn't be criticized. They should be criticized. What I'm mostly suggesting here is that some of the criticism is based on issues like there's a critique that he has spent too much money and that our deficits have been trillion-dollar deficits each year over the last 4 years. I think that's a legitimate criticism. The unemployment rate has been above 8% most of his presidency. I think that's a legitimate criticism. Some of the other criticisms, though, for instance, this sort of broad criticism that Obama doesn't understand how the free market economy works, not that you said that, but that's something that Romney has said over and over again. Well, hey, last Friday, the Dow Jones closed above 13,000 for the third Friday in a row. The Dow has essentially doubled during Obama's presidency. So if unemployment is an indicator that he's done a bad job, I think you have to take something like the doubling of the Dow Jones as an indicator that he has done a good job in that regard for business, or that let's say that he knows something about the economy. Neither of those things means you got to vote one way or another. I just think the criticism should be based on what he's done. As far as your comment about the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm not so sure about that, but you know, I'll check into that. You made an interesting point, Nathan, about gay marriage. Obama obviously has come out in favor of gay marriage, and he pushed through the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think that's an interesting point that you raised, because even though it sounds like you're expressing an opposition to Obama's stance on that, I do think polling is showing that increasingly Americans are in favor of gay rights. They were overwhelmingly in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That doesn't mean you have to agree with it, but that was something that more than 70% of people are for. I listened to Kathleen. Kathleen, I listened to your show on Thursday. You had the professor on talking about gun control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what struck me about gun control and the debate we've been having lately is that there are some social issue debates that Republicans, or I should say conservatives, have clearly won, and then there are some social issue debates that liberals have clearly won. So, for example, conservatives are winning the gun control debate. They just are. President Obama and all the way down the Democratic line, there's no move to implement further gun control because it's a losing political issue. Similarly, I think on the side of gay rights, same-sex marriage, for instance, even though you've seen a trend of states voting to implement bans on gay marriage, in my view, this is an issue that conservatives have already lost. This is complete speculation on my part, but when this issue goes to the Supreme Court, I think conservatives are going to be surprised at how the Supreme Court votes on this. I think it's going to be a pretty solid 6-3 or 7-2 decision upholding the right of same-sex couples to marry. And then I also think that this is probably going to be the last presidential election where someone on either major party ticket can be against same-sex marriage and expect to get any significant percentage of the youth vote. It's just demographics. It's just going that
mm-hmm.
way.
The times.
So I understand your question. Yeah, sorry, Kathleen.
The times have changed.
The times are changing. Yeah, definitely.
More phone calls in a moment. David Zwerdlik is our guest for All Things Political, contributing editor for The Root. We will continue taking phone calls. Our lines are filled, so just be patient. We'll be with you. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. When we return, we'll hear from Vice President Joe Biden, who spoke last Tuesday at a campaign rally in Virginia, and get response. I know some of you want to talk about that, and we want to hear David's response. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And here are Vice President Joe Biden's comments from last Tuesday.
Romney wants to let he said in the first 100 days, he's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
You wrote a piece, Now Romney Knows How Black People Feel. What did you mean by that?
Well, look, I don't condone, first of all, what Joe Biden said, and I thought it was, in addition to being inexcusable and unnecessary, it goes back to what I was talking about the negative campaigning. It's one thing for the Obama-Biden ticket to say, hey, you can't risk America's future on Romney's plans for taxes or for Medicare. It's another thing for him to go out there and say he's going to put you back in chains. There's just not a lot of evidence, in my view, that kind of comment is warranted. There is a racial undertone to that comment, and what I wrote about in the piece is that whether you're talking about putting y'all back in chains or whether you're talking about some of the things that are said from the conservative side toward Obama, these are comments that you can never quite prove are racial in nature, but anybody who's been around for any amount of time, you hear it as racial. So I think that the Biden comment, y'all back in chains, there's no proof, there's no smoking gun that says, hey, he's race baiting, but it sounds racial to the average person's ear. Similarly, you've had comments from Republicans like Newt Gingrich saying that Obama is the quote-unquote food stamp president. There's no proof that that's a racial comment, but it just sounds like it to the average person. And so my criticism there in saying, hey, now Romney knows how black people feel, I essentially was writing, you know, the Romney campaign got kind of miffed when they heard that comment, and I don't blame them. And now what they should do is be willing to call out those same kind of comments on their own side of the political aisle, whether it's Gingrich saying food stamp president, or whether it's I think Santorum at one point in the campaign said something similar about food stamps. Another example that I put in the piece was this wasn't even coded. This was just Herman Cain when he was still in the race, and obviously the only African American candidate on the Republican side, said that Obama wasn't "quote unquote" a real black man, and then I think again there's other condescending type of comments. Just call it out on both sides. When conservatives hear Biden, they call him out. Call it out on your own side too, and then I think it's fair because none of these comments really look. It's a free country. Everybody, including the vice president, has the right to say what he wants, but then the public on both sides should be willing to say, hey, this is uncalled for. That was really the point of the piece.
Here are a couple comments on Facebook I'd like for you to respond to. Jeremy, should Biden apologize? No. If you get rid of the regulations on Wall Street and the financial sector and insurance companies, we will have millions of Americans who suffer from the viciousness of unrestrained capitalism. Sherry on Facebook, on the other hand, writes, Biden's comments, if said by a Republican, would have been devastating, but liberals are trying to explain it, this very racist statement.
Well, let me talk about Sherry's post first there, because I think that gets to the core of what I was writing about. In other words, you've heard several people say that. Say, yeah, if a conservative or a Republican had said what Biden has said, there would have been, you know, exponentially more outcry. And that's probably right. But conservatives and Republicans do say comments like that, like food stamp president. Have conservatives called people out on their own side for making those comments? I would say most often not. Yes, the Obama-Biden campaign has sort of defended its own remarks. The campaign consultants and the spokespeople and Obama have all sort of stuck by Biden on this, as they really have to. It's their campaign. But you've had other Democrats, notably Douglas Wilder, who is African-American and the former governor of Virginia, which is the state where the comment was made, he condemned Biden. And, you know, lots of people, I think, have come out and said Biden was over the top. To your other commenter there on Facebook, not to get into I'm rubber, you're glue type of analysis, but I think the answer, again, is I think if Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich and Romney apologize for some of the things they or their campaign people have said, then sure, Biden should apologize too. That's my sole point in this particular issue, is it has to be called out evenly on both sides, or else it's a complete double standard.
Yeah. Mark in Appleton, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It just seems to me that all this outrage about Joe Biden's comments is almost a smokescreen. I mean, a group of bankers and people in the real estate industry committing fraud. The Bush administration did not enforce regulations. The SEC went to sleep. There still seems asleep. And yet we're all upset about this comment by Joe Biden. And the fact is that Romney and Ryan are against Dodd-Frank. They're against any kind of new regulation. They're against, they're clearly not going to be interested in putting bankers who committed fraud back in jail. And yet we're upset about this comment by Joe Biden instead of a fact of the world economy was almost completely destroyed. And we were on the brink of depression, and Obama did, with the stimulus and things, we're able to avert that.
David.
Yeah, no, well, is it Mark? I'm sorry. Mark, I think you made an excellent point, and I think it sounds like you really have strong feelings on this. And my response to that would be this. Okay, there's a lot of really crucial issues. I think people on all parts of the political spectrum would agree that there are some really crucial foreign policy and economic and social issues that have to be addressed in the U.S., and our country sort of can't afford a silly debate at this time. I think most people would agree with that. But here's the thing. It's incumbent upon the candidates to make it about that then. Vice President Biden has been in Congress for 36 years, and he's been the Vice President of the United States for 4 years. That's 40 years in very high elected office. If he can't figure out now that saying put y'all back in chains isn't going to become a whirlwind and a distraction from whatever else he's trying to say, then that I really have to put the onus on him for that. And then that goes, again, to both sides of the aisle. To your point about Romney and Ryan and some of their policies, I do want to get into the stimulus a little later, if that's okay, Kathleen, because I actually
sure.
think that's something that, to me, is more interesting about Congressman Ryan than all the stuff about Medicare that's been talked so much about. If you want to get back to it, Kathleen, we can, but let me just say this now. Congressman Ryan, and your listeners are in Wisconsin primarily, so I know they're familiar with his record. Yesterday on TV, on the Chris Hayes show on MSNBC, they talked about this issue, and they actually kind of pulled up an article from the Racine, is it the Journal Times in Racine, from January of 2002, and this is what Romney said. I actually wrote it down. I wanted to get the quote exactly right. This is what Paul Ryan said. Quote, "You have to spend a little to grow a little. What we're trying to do is stimulate that part of the economy that's on its back." Now, to me, my first reaction to that is, how is that different from what Obama said in 2009 with the stimulus? So I think you're right, Mark, that we're being distracted away from some other issues. But we can go more into Paul Ryan's record and the stimulus. But I think that's really a challenge in our politics right now. Kathleen, I think you probably agree,
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, okay.
And it is the Journal Times. You got a good memory.
Okay.
Back to Biden for just a moment.
Sure.
Has it reached the point, everybody makes fun, even the president makes fun of Joe Biden at times, has it reached a point where the ticket simply can't afford these distractions that Joe Biden gives us, and they need to come down hard on him to make sure that he's scripted, perhaps? Or should they entertain the possibility at this late date of removing him, or is that goofy?
That's been talked about since the very beginning. I think that if they had an inclination to replace Biden, that window of opportunity has come and gone. We're really down the home stretch. The Republican convention is next week. The Democratic convention is the week after that. And then it's about 2 months until Election Day. There may have been a case for replacing Biden with, say, Secretary of State Clinton at an earlier stage, but I think that window's passed. And here's where I think, Kathleen, more importantly, I don't think any of the parties involved wanted that. I doubt Biden wanted to be sort of demoted, right? I mean, they could have just switched him, right? If they had put Clinton on the ticket, then if the Obama-Clinton ticket, the hypothetical Obama-Clinton ticket, won the one election, they could make Senator Biden, or excuse me, Vice President Biden, the Secretary of State. After all, he was the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair at one point. But I don't think Biden wanted that. And I really, really don't think, this is speculation again on my part, that I haven't done any reporting on this, but my sense of it is that the Obama camp and the Clinton camp are sort of frenemies, right? They've got to get along in public. They basically agree on policy issues. They've worked together, and they'll continue to work together. But these aren't close camps. You know, I don't think Clinton has any interest of saving Obama's bacon, and I don't think Obama has any interest in giving Clinton the satisfaction. That's baked into the cake now. So we'll see what happens. As far to your original question, Kathleen, about Biden and his gaffes, again, I think that's baked into the cake. Sometimes his sort of folksy, I'll say what I think and I think what I say kind of mannerisms, that sometimes works to their advantage.
Right.
Right. I mean, if your listeners will recall, it was in 2007 when both then Senator Biden and Senator Obama were both in the Democratic presidential primary. Biden was the guy who said, "Oh, Barack Obama, he's a young guy. He's the first bright and clean and articulate African-American guy to run for president." Well, I think Obama handled that perfectly. He didn't get upset about it. He didn't make a big deal out of it. He let it lay, and then he turned around and said, "Hey, Joe Biden, I want you to be my running mate." And I think people applauded that. That kind of worked to their advantage then. Now Biden's antics, if you will, are working a little bit to their disadvantage. This probably will vanish in a few weeks. We'll get back to, as Mark said, some real issues.
Right. John in Magnolia. Hi.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My comment was, it seems like a lot of the issues that really matter are going almost unnoticed while they divide America. We keep bickering about what Biden said about being back in chains. I'll give you one example. Geithner and these others, you know, working for these banks and AIG that they give promotions to and put them in charge of setting financial policy, that goes across Republican-Democrat lines. You know, they serve for both Republican-Democrat, and there's powers at work that are bigger than Republican-Democrat that I think people would... I wish people would spend more attention and focus on, like, you know, what's really going on at the Fed, but we really don't. We talk about, you know, what comments were said at a speech and stuff like that. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. David?
Yeah, John, I think you raise an excellent point as well. It's not unlike the one that was brought up by the last caller. And let me just say this. I don't know what side of the political aisle you're on, and it doesn't matter for this purpose, but let me just say this. It sounds in a way like you had a little bit of a critique, not so much we've been talking about the critique of that conservatives have of Obama, but in a way you were articulating some of the critique that progressives have had of Obama, that he was a little bit too enthralled to corporate America. He appointed Geithner as his Treasury Secretary. And you know, I understand those criticisms. I happen to be one that says, you know, show me someone who would have really taken on the big banks. Show me someone who would not have done the TARP bailout. Show me someone who would have railed against corporate America, and I'll show you someone who would not be president of the United States. Obama, at the end of the day, is a politician. I think because of the way he campaigned in 2008, he raised some expectations on the left among progressives that this was going to be a whole new kind of politics. But if you read between the lines, you know, in between hope and change, if you read what he was saying on this policy or that policy, whether it was the banks or Afghanistan, he was saying some pretty regular president-type stuff. You know, he said we're going to shut it down in Iraq, but we're going to ramp it up in Afghanistan. And that's what he did. His last meaningful vote as a U.S. senator was voting in favor of TARP, as did Ryan, as did Biden, and as I'm sure Romney would have had he been in Congress. These are mainstream guys. It's very hard at this stage in our politics for someone either on the right or the left far end of the spectrum who's not a mainstream guy to get to be president or vice president. And so I think the range of issues that either Obama or Romney would address as president is a lot narrower than I think some people had hoped or would hope or even that covers all of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very valid point, but I'm not sure what the answer is to that right now.
Yeah. And yet there are people who are pointing to this era in which we live as being one of fundamental unfairness, David. And I'd like for you to address that for a moment, because when you look at tax rates, when you look at the issue of a 13% tax rate from somebody who's making a whole lot of money, when you look at executive salaries and people who are just working everyday jobs, when you look at kids who are getting out of college and they have to work three jobs, when you look at the number of people who are in line for free breakfast and lunch programs, which I see every day as I drive to work, it seems to me as though there is a change going on in this country that neither party seems to be addressing. And I'm wondering why that is the case. Why is it the case that almost another depression in this country, nobody faced criminal charges for that? It was a big thing to have done, to take the money and run and then to give yourself bonuses. I mean, do you see where I'm going with this? There's something that a lot of people are saying is fundamentally wrong, that everybody's playing along because, well, you know, you can't upset the apple cart here.
Well, upset the apple cart is the perfect way to put it. And honestly, Kathleen, I think you just articulated that better than any of the presidential candidates have articulated that issue. And I think there's a lot of people out there, your listeners, who could articulate it or have articulated it better than Obama or Romney, this issue of income inequality and this issue of people sort of feeling like the deck is stacked against them. But back to your point about upsetting the apple cart, that's really the thing, right, is that I don't want your listeners to think I'm making an excuse for Obama or what a hypothetical President Romney would do. Just the fact is that what it takes in a country of 3 million people to rise up to the top and become the president, mm-hmm. you're almost by definition a no upset the apple cart kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't elect typically. We haven't in my lifetime elected someone who's going to tip over the apple cart. To your point about articulating these issues, let's look at it this way. I actually would say something slightly different. I wouldn't say that the parties are not addressing these issues. I would say that both sides are addressing this issue of income inequality and taxation and fairness, but they're doing it from their own sort of ideological framework and talking right past each other, right? So there is an interesting ideological debate going on, and this is what I wanted to actually get into with Paul Ryan. There's this interesting ideological debate going on. A lot of conservatives say, hey, the New Deal was the New Deal. That was a different time, an industrial era. We're in a world and a society now where the government just can't take care of people like it used to. Conservatives say they're philosophically opposed to that, and then, moreover, we just don't have the money anymore, okay? And then the Democratic argument is, well, but look how happy people are with their health care in Canada and Sweden. The wealthy have so much, surely we can raise their taxes 4% so that we can have more social services. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Right.
But neither side is giving credit to the other side's argument, right? I mean, there would be a better argument, it seems to me, if conservatives said, okay, we can't afford the social safety net, but we understand why there's benefits to it, so that people are not out on the street without medical care, without food, et cetera. And then there would be a better side. You know, there was this whole thing with Obama a few weeks ago saying, quote unquote, you didn't build that. I'm sure you talked about that on your show. That whole debate, it would be better, I think, if Obama said, okay, entrepreneurs, okay, business owners, you have worked hard, you've put in long hours, you've used your skill and ingenuity, and I commend you for that. Oh, by the way, though, just remember that the government helped you with roads, schools, bridges, fire department, police department, clean water, clean air, etc. But that's not what he said, right? And so both sides are talking about this a lot. They're just going right past each other, and people have kind of divided into camps, and that's where we are. Kathleen, is it all right if I say something about Paul Ryan here?
Well, why not?
Why not?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. Congressman from Janesville, Wisconsin. This, to me, is where I take a little bit of an issue with Ryan. I think he clearly has a lot of ideas, although I don't precisely think he's on the right track with his premium support or voucher Medicare solution. I think it's an interesting proposal. I think he is getting into the meat and potatoes of entitlement reform that probably needs to happen. My criticism of Ryan stems more on the level of him really, really working off of a double standard in terms of what he's done in his career versus what Obama's done as president. Ryan voted in Congress. Remember, Ryan's been in Congress for 14 years. That's 10 years longer than Obama was in Congress. You know, he's a much younger guy, but he's been in Congress most of his adult life, okay? He voted in favor of the Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit. You know, estimates vary now, but at the time it was estimated to be about $700 billion. He voted for both auto bailouts. He voted for the TARP bailout. He voted for the Iraq War, $800 billion and counting. Forget Iraq. Forget about the cost in lives and prestige. Just the money, $800 billion. And then, you know, before I was talking about how he had supported previous stimulus packages. So for him to turn around now and say that President Obama is essentially can't make the tough decisions on the economy or is running up huge deficits that are going to crater the free market economy, I just think it's operating on a very, very, very steep double standard. And I, to me, frankly, this would be a better track for the Obama campaign to take than getting into this sort of grudge match over Medicare. Mm. But, you know, we'll see.
David Zwerdlich, our guest for All Things Political. He's contributing editor for The Root. It's a daily online magazine providing commentary on the news. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can also send an email at talk@WPR.org or go to the Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Tony in Tomahawk. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. I know your guest and the listeners value accuracy, and there was a caller earlier who said that Obama has raised deficits more than all other presidents combined, and I'm waiting for a response from you, Kathleen, or from the guest. It's just completely inaccurate, and it's a little complicated to discuss this, but Obama inherited the largest deficit he inherited from George Bush. Obama was under the Bush budget when he became president. He was 4 months into the last Bush budget, which was the largest deficit ever. Obama has decreased the deficit somewhat, and he's actually spent less than Bush. Those are facts that you can look them up. Obama, when he became president, the deficit was close to $11 trillion. It's now close to $16 trillion. George Bush actually doubled the deficit while he was in office.
David.
So it's clear that this just is not accurate.
David.
Yeah, Tony, no, thank you for bringing that up. You know, I will, you know, sort of confess that I'm more of a guy covering politics as opposed to the nuts and bolts of policy. But I think you're right that the year-over-year deficits, which are $1 trillion, give or take, have come down slightly under Obama relative to Bush. So I think that's a good, fair point for you to point out. That being said, the national debt, not the year-over-year, but the overall national debt, has gone up, as you said, from $11 trillion to $15 trillion. So I do think, and this is kind of what I was saying before, I do think it's a fair criticism to say, hey, Obama is still spending money that we're borrowing. And even though there are reasons for that, and even though I think it's fair to say that he borrowed money in part because of stimulus efforts to keep to bring the growth rate back up, the GDP growth rate back up, it's still adding to the national debt. So I think that's a fair criticism of him. Both sides, Republicans and Democrats, have these competing plans which bring the deficit down over a long trajectory, right? Either out to 2020, 2030, 2040. No one has a plan out there right now that says, hey, we're going to wipe out these deficits in the next 5 years. Not because it would be totally impossible, but it's almost impossible, both politically and in terms of you can't take that much money out of the national economic bloodstream and expect the economy to grow. Where I think Obama has a better case, Tony, is not so much on the debt and deficit issue, it's on the growth rate issue. Romney and Ryan and other conservatives have hammered Obama on the fact that we only have like a 1.5% growth rate right now. Well, relative to the negative growth rate that he inherited when he came in, that's positive territory, right? It doesn't mean he solved all our economic problems. It doesn't mean that there's not heavy lifting to do. But when you go from negative growth to positive growth, I think it's you have to say that that's an improvement, if nothing else. And it goes against this idea that they say regularly on the campaign trail that Obama has, quote unquote, made things worse. But made things worse clearly is in the eye of the beholder. And I think the debt thing is something fair. By the way, Kathleen and Tony, if Romney is elected, I think conservatives are going to be surprised at how little the Romney-Ryan team and the Republicans in Congress do cut the debt. I mean, there's a reason why Ryan's plan doesn't cut the debt for until 2030. Doesn't make a significant chunk. And there's a reason why he puts off. I think I said that wrong. But in any case, he puts off cuts in Medicare, for instance, until people who are now under the age of 55 go on Medicare. It's because you no matter how much of a quote unquote fiscal hawk you are, it's very hard to do this all at once. You're talking about the world's largest economy. You're talking about a country with 300 million people, 50 states. You just can't slam on the brakes like that. So if Romney's the president, it's not going to be a conservative dream come true overnight. There's no question about that.
Steve in Eau Claire, hi. Whoa, Steve, it's noisy. Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please, Steve.
Yes, I just wanted to make the point. We are talking about Democrats and Republicans, liberals, conservatives, and who's favoring more of the tax situation. It's a problem of both parties, and both parties over a long period of time have created the problem. Mainly what we look at now is we have a tax code, tax law, that is printed on 70,000 pages. Most Western industrialized nations are 1,600, 1,700, 1,800 pages. A lot of paper, a lot of tax law. Ours is 70,000. They say it's about 4.5 feet of paper. And we've gotten that way because everyone that's ever been in politics has someone they owe. And so they've worked out to get their little piece through Congress, give a break here, give a break there. If we completely wipe that slate clean, got rid of it, and said, let's start over, and there are no tax breaks for anyone, for any reason. Now, that sounds terrible in the sense, what about the middle class, and they have it for their mortgage loan? Most people have mortgages of some sort or another, but what they would be taking home more in their paycheck every week.
David.
Steve, again, Kathleen, you have really well-informed listeners. I think that there was a lot packed into Steve's comments, so let me see if I can unpack it real quick. I don't want to pick on you, Steve, but let me just say one place where I agree with you and one place where I don't quite agree with you. I think your overall point that the problems we have are bipartisan, and if we're going to solve them, the solutions are bipartisan. I totally agree with that. What I'm not as persuaded by is those arguments that say, oh, our tax code is 77,000 pages, or Obamacare, the bill was 2,700 pages. Either a law, in my view, is good or bad. It doesn't matter how many pages there are in it. If someone likes Obamacare, then, hey, it had 2,700 pages. If Paul Ryan becomes the vice president and Ryan's Medicare premium support plan is enacted, it's going to have, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. That's just the way our laws are. But I do see your point. I think that in terms of the issue that Steve – Steve raised this really good point about the influence of lobbying and money in politics. Again, this is the system that we have, and until there's more of a groundswell to sort of have a counter reaction to it, whether that's the Tea Party or whether it's the Occupy movement, it will continue like this because politicians do have an incentive to, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? There's a way you can read, if I can switch gears on you a little here, Kathleen.
Sure.
There's a way you can read James Madison in Federalist 51. You know, I'm sure, just based on the comments, I know you've got listeners out there who have dog-eared and highlighted the Federalist Papers. So if you go into Federalist 51, there is a way you can read it where Madison is saying the way to run a democracy or a republic is not to take money and interest groups out. It's to have lots of interest groups, and those interest groups have to compete for the government's attention. Whether that has served us well in recent years is clearly up for debate. But we have a system where, you know, one group organizes and another group has to organize to counteract it. Yeah.
David, thank you so much. We are out of time. Thank you. I hope you'll join us again.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank
Kathleen.
You. David Zwerdlich, our guest, he is contributing editor for The Root. It's a daily online magazine that provides commentary on the news from a variety of black perspectives. It's a very interesting website. So go read James Madison and check out The Root as well. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up momentarily and then another hour with Lori Winters. So please stay with us on the Ideas Network.